It's time now for Oh, the Humanities, taking a look at humanities scholarship research and events on campus and beyond. Presented by Carolina Public Humanities, humanities.unc.edu is their website for more information on events and happenings. We are joined in the studio, as always, by the man who heads up Carolina Public Humanities, Max Orr. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. You know, I think this whole Groundhog Day, this year, Punxsutawney Phil came out and let out a lot of hot air because it's 70-something degrees out. It must be roasting up there. Unbelievably seasonal, unseasonable weather. But I'm not complaining.
That's fine. He predicted an early spring.
He
didn't
did.
He?
In fact, that's right. Said it's tomorrow. Here it is, right?
Yeah. Well, but then Sir Walter Wally in Raleigh predicted 6 more weeks of winter. So I don't know what he was.
Well, you know, I think that if this is winter, then we're living in climate change times
100%.
Well, at any rate, I have, as you know, I bring you things related to today's date, and try as I may, I tried to find something germane to our topic, and it wasn't at all, but it is still interesting, because everyone knows the concept of the day the music died.
Okay.
And this was, of course, a tragic day on February 3rd, 1959, when Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and the Big Bopper, and of course other people on the plane went down, thus inspiring the Don McLean song, and many people doing the What Ifs. I will say one thing about the What Ifs. No one ever What Ifs the Big Bopper.
True, right? Everyone around What Ifs Ritchie Valens, right?
Ritchie Valens or Buddy Holly, what would they have done? So that's what we have today, and it has nothing to do with our topic.
I don't know. Rock music was kind of the defining characteristic of American culture during the Cold War. Can we segue anything to anything.
Absolutely. You've been a teacher before, haven't you? I can tell. Well, we have a wonderful seminar coming up, a dialogue seminar. You know, the shorter version, we put two scholars together. And often our dialogue seminars have a theme that we repeat. And one of the themes we've done quite a bit are great cities. And so we have a great cities dialogue coming up, great cities of Eastern Europe. And we're going to be looking at Prague and St. Petersburg. And I have one of our scholars in the studio with us today. That's Chad Bryan, associate professor of history. And he's going to be giving a talk, Why Do Travelers Go to Prague and What Cultures Do They Find There. So I guess the first thing I want to ask you, Chad, you've been to Prague, right?
Yeah, I've been a few times, yeah.
So why are you taking this particular approach to this topic? Why do travelers go there and what cultures do they find there? What inspired you to take that approach to thinking about great cities?
Yeah, well, it's actually coming out of a book that I'm publishing right now. And one thing that kind of brought me to makes Prague really fascinating is that on the one hand, it's sort of it's a great city that is both a stage and a museum for Czech nationalism. But on the other hand, it's like any city, it's a magnet for difference. And that's so some of these cultures you're going to see and some you aren't. And the latter, the difference, is very hard to see sometimes for people who go there for the first time with just a guidebook in hand.
What drew you to Prague in the first place?
I was an English teacher in a small town a declining steel town about 2.5 hours east of Prague, and I actually disliked Prague a lot at that time. We were very proud of ourselves for living far away.
When was this?
In the early 90s, okay. 93, yeah.
That's a time of change then, right? Seeing it right after. So I imagine, speaking of the Cold War, you were probably, when you were in Prague, in the Czech Republic, it had already split from Czechoslovakia, the Slovak Republic, and the Czech Republic, and did you get a sense of the remnants of the Cold War even when you were there? Were you seeing a society rebuilding, or was it a very quick transformation?
It was definitely, and I guess it was a mixture of both, because on the one hand, privatization came very quickly, and I worked actually in a private high school, and I taught engineers and managers in this steel factory that was quickly going under, which was being undermined by capitalism. But at the same time, like, people still watched the similar TV shows, they still told some of the same stories, and actually they kind of narrated the nation in their own sort of sense of self in ways that they had from the 80s. So it was a really interesting point of transition.
What's different today versus 93?
In Prague, I think, well, one thing is now that, I mean, for better or for worse, the city has been renovated. Mm-hmm. It's been, before, coal was the predominant sort of fuel throughout the city, and so everything was gray, and it smelled like coal, like, throughout the winter. And now everything's really clean and renovated. And now, of course, too, there's a lot of tourists who come to Prague, especially in the middle and the center of the city, which is a major source of revenue, which wasn't true in the 90s. You couldn't, like, you couldn't like find a place to stay without trouble early
like
on.
Kafka lovers want the coal smell, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I miss the coal smell a lot, as environmentally as unsound as it is.
It's like nostalgia for pollution. But
Yeah.
So, you know, interesting thing, you had mentioned even in the title, and you know, a lot of times we associate cities with cosmopolitanism, you know, in the sense that there are a lot of cultures there. I'm also curious about what this does to nations, and in particular, in our particular moment in time in history, we have a sort of a town and a rural and urban divide, and I'm wondering if that exists in the Czech Republic, and what role does Prague play in thinking about the difference between Czech national identity and Prague as maybe a center of cosmopolitanism? Is it a similar dynamic that you see between rural, urban?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of throughout the region in Warsaw, Poland, and Budapest, and Hungary, and Prague, and the Czech Republic, is that these three cities have benefited immensely since the fall of communism. A lot of wealth has been concentrated in these cities. This is where political power is. This is where young people go to university and therefore become part of these new European networks. And in many cases, the rest of the country has been left behind. Not always, in every place. And so there's a big, big divide. And also because cities are magnets, right? They attract not just capital and money, but they also attract people from all over. And so Prague is more diverse, you know, ethnically and in many other ways than the rest of the country as well.
Has that diversity grown since you were first visiting in the early 90s in terms of, you know, other communities?
Actually, it has grown in some ways because now there are a lot of, you know, day workers from the Ukraine. There are refugees from former Yugoslavia, but there are some, such as the group that I study or looked at in this last chapter, was there were many Vietnamese, for example, before the fall of communism.
Interesting.
And
mm-hmm.
And then that population number went up a little bit after 89, but many of the Vietnamese who came there as migrant workers in the 80s, they stayed, and their families, they brought families with them afterwards.
Very interesting.
Speaking with Max Orr, of course, and Chad Bryan, historian at UNC, the event that we're talking about is this Saturday, February 8th at 9 a.m., the great cities of Eastern Europe, Prague and St. Petersburg. So we're talking about Prague. The other talk will be about St. Petersburg, Russia. And then there will be a panel discussion called Do the Great Cities of Eastern Europe Have Global Significance in the 21st Century? Which I assume the answer is going to be yes in some form or fashion. But
otherwise, I'd be out of a job.
It's the question of what's the form or fashion, right?
Right.
So what can you speak about some of the global significance of Eastern European cities?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, like you said, they kind of embody a larger sort of development in the 21st century of the concentration of capital and people into big cities and the enormous growth of cities. I mean, this even more so in non-European cities where in places like Beijing or large African cities actually can be almost our countries unto themselves in some ways.
And the interesting thing about, I mentioned this in my class, that, you know, if you look at elites who are involved in financial systems or, you know, world trade and whatnot, world culture and whatnot, you often find that there might be elites in London that are more similar to elites in Shanghai than they are to, in both cases, than those people are to their own country people. And I've already asked you a little bit about that divide in Czechoslovakia. Is it that extreme even that you might have a financial elite in Prague that really is part of a culture that's more New York and London and, I don't know, Moscow, Kiev?
Yeah, I don't think it'd be that as extreme as that, even though there is this obviously sort of it's better to think of it in terms of networks. So there are students, for example, who go to university in Prague, but because of the Erasmus Fellowship have studied elsewhere in Europe. There are professionals who travel the world or have, you know, internet conversations with similar professionals throughout the world, and they speak English too, which is a big deal. But unlike a lot of other countries, and especially in Eastern Europe, there's been almost no brain drain. Many of the well-educated university elites within the country have remained in the country, and so there's still, for whatever reason, still a more groundedness to the local culture and among these elites.
So with all of that in mind, your talk on Saturday is going to be kind of focused on the experience of travelers. How do you tackle all of this from that perspective in the short amount of time that you have? What's the approach?
Yeah, well, I'm going to start off with sort of the approach that what happens when you pick up a guidebook and go to Prague. And you're going to be given this sort of this standard narrative of the triumphant sort of march of Czech history. And what that sort of narrative and what you're supposed to see as you walk through the city is very different if you all of a sudden start to find places that speak to peoples or groups or even personalities that don't fit that common narrative, that are written out of that history. And this is the same history that, in many ways, that middle schoolers are getting in the Czech Republic now. And I think it's interesting to play with that. And also it's interesting to travel, for example, just to go back to the Vietnamese community. Prague has the largest Vietnamese market in all of Europe.
Wow.
And you can go there, you can take a bus and walk through, and I've never been to Vietnam, but you are walking to a very different place.
Yeah,
you don't hear
yeah.
Czech anymore. There's shops, there's a Vietnamese school, there's a Vietnamese travel agency, and obviously restaurants and so forth too.
I remember when I was in middle school in social studies class, we spent the entire year on a particular country. Each of us had our own. And I got so much information. My country happened to be the Soviet Union. It was 1991, which was a fascinating year to be assigned that particular country. But I got so much information out of travel guides about the country. And it's I don't know if it's heartening or disappointing, but it's something to hear that the information that middle school students in that country get is going to be fairly similar to the story that you get in the guidebooks.
Yeah, but that said, I mean, in defense of travel guides, like they're also a great historical primary source.
Oh yeah,
and I
kind
of use them throughout this book, especially in the early 19th century, because this was the beginning of a moment when people from all over Europe were traveling to Prague, and they can tell you about things that the newspapers weren't telling you about. Some travelogues went to places and described populations, they described parts of the city, or they described like strange customs that others wouldn't have noticed.
So how has the travelogue changed over the last couple hundred years?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I think, well, in the first place, it began really in the 18th century as a genre. And I guess in some ways, that's a good question. In some ways, the genre hasn't really changed that much.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, you are the intrepid traveler. You're discovering something new. You're always the one discovering something new,
even though
some people have been there before. And a good travelogue is actually about the author, typically, right? It's the author's experiences doing this. Paul Thoreau is one of my favorite travel writers. And in the end, like, he goes to all these places, and you learn about these places through his eyes, but in the end, the great drama is whether he can, like, sit down and read a book on a train without being bothered.
You know, one of the things you were saying about things that are outside of the travelogue or things that are outside of the guidebook, and one of the things that's great about European cities is that they tend to be walkable. You know, they're and I always tell people when they go to Paris and they say, what should I visit? Well, like, sure, you can go to the Eiffel Tower. You can get any guidebook. Is Prague a good city to walk around and get a sense of its variety and diversity if you're walking through the city and checking it out?
No, absolutely. I mean, it's a very walkable city. It also has a fantastic tram system, so you can take trams very quickly from one point to the other, and subway too. And also, Prague was not bombed during World War II, and so it's this great sort of, you know, it's overused word palimpsest of different architectural styles that you can see literally by just walking 10 minutes in one direction. You can see these different layers of history.
I will just go out on a limb and say that the word palimpsest is not overused.
I was thinking the exact same. That's the first time that word has ever been described as
it's
overused.
It's a wonderful
ever.
Word and one of my favorite words. Look it up, listening audience, if you don't know it.
Don't become an urban historian.
Go ahead. I just got to start wrapping up. We're speaking with Chad Bryan, Associate Professor of History, The Great Cities of Eastern Europe, Prague and St. Petersburg. He'll be talking about Prague. Louise McReynolds will be talking about St. Petersburg, and then everyone together for a panel afterward. It's Saturday, February 8th, 9 a.m. Get more information at humanities.unc.edu.
Max. I just want to put in a word for Louise McReynolds. Has a really wonderful take on St. Petersburg, and she has a great excuse for not being here. She was with family in Kansas City watching the game.
That's fair.
So had to come back today. I thought she was in Miami, and I said that would be even cooler, but at least they won, and she'll be a happy camper this weekend.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't have that much far to go because Miami is also in Kansas, right?
Yeah.
Other events coming up that people want to
know? Well, absolutely. We, of course, have our starting next week, Humanities in Action will be kicking off, so I'll be bringing in some of those great guests who will be talking about technology, culture, and society. Always go to our humanities.unc.edu or follow us on Facebook for Cinema School, our great books. We do have room in just about every one of our seminars except for Bart Ehrman's seminar coming up. So line up, sign up, get involved, come and register.
Awesome. Again, this particular seminar, Great Cities of Eastern Europe, this Saturday morning at 9 a.m., humanities.unc.edu for that and more. Max, Chad, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.